Phil Rosenzweig, welcome to the Bookshelf Conversations.
Thank you for having me, Ron. Good to be here.
So this is your new book, One Splendid Season: Baseball in America in 1912. It is a very handsome book. It is coming out just in time for the holidays because this makes, in my opinion, this makes a great book for on several levels, for baseball fans, for fans of history, for fans of art, because these cards are very artistic. Let's talk about the genesis of the book first.
Well, some people say, how did you choose to write about 1912 with baseball cards? Actually, it's the other way around. I began with the set. This is a set that I've collected since I was in high school, which goes back a long time. I completed the set in the early 90s, and I just love the set for the end panels, which look like T205s. They have this wonderful center panel. Here, I'll show you one. So you have the end panels that are the same as T205s, except they have white borders instead of gold. The center panels have these beautiful black and white photos. They are the first examples, to my knowledge, of fast shutter speed photography on baseball cards. And then the backs have very extensive captions. And so I just loved so much about this set, and I thought it would be nice to create an annotated presentation. And that was really the genesis. I wanted to annotate the set and present it to readers in terms of the end panels, the center panel, and the back. And then the question was, well, how do you do that? Do you list them alphabetically? Do you list them according to a checklist? Do you group them by team? And it seemed to me that the season when these cards came out, 1912, was such a historic season for so many reasons. It would make sense to organize the presentation beginning on opening day, going through May, 4th of July series, some of the climactic series in September, all the way to the World Series. And so the season became the organizing principle to present this wonderful set of cards.
And now I'm wondering about the title because it says Baseball and America in 1912. So what is the America part?
Well, the captions on the back tell us a whole lot about not just the players, but where they came from, the mill towns, the coal mines, what their careers were like, what the society was like. The geography of the country comes through, the way that places were described. You have, I think, the people who wrote the captions were on the East Coast, and they would talk about California as the land of grapes and raisins. They would talk about Tris Speaker as a cowboy from the plains of North Texas. And you had a number of players who came from coal mining towns, either in eastern Pennsylvania or Mordecai Brown from Illinois. So there's just a lot there about that time for our society and how it was growing. And then in the book, I found lots of articles from newspapers, contemporaneous articles to describe games. And a lot of these captions, sorry, a lot of the articles talk about the society in this time of America in the first decade of the 20th century. So baseball becomes a way to explore how the country was developing, and that's why I chose this title.
Talk a little bit about the you said T205, I believe you said.
Sure.
What does that mean? Because I know the Hannes Wagner card is from the T206 generation, isn't it? So what is the T designation?
Okay, well, at the time these cards came out, nobody called them by those designations. They were formulated years later by a man named Jefferson Burdick, who was a collector of paper collectibles, not just sports collectibles, all kinds of things, patriotic items, Valentine's Day cards. And he had a classification system, tobacco cards, cards that were inserted in packs of cigarettes, had the T designation. Now, curiously, he didn't order them chronologically. So the T206 card came out in 1909, 1910. And that's a set that is very famous. The Onis Wagner card was one of those. That was called the T206. In 1911, the American Tobacco Company, this was the big tobacco monopoly of the time that had lots of different brands. They came out that year with a set that was called T205, but it came out a year later than T206. And those came out, these have these beautiful portraits and a gold border. That came out in 1911. In 1912, again, American Tobacco Company wanted a card to insert in packages of Hassan cork tip cigarettes. And what they did is they took the end panel of the T205, they took two of the end panels, and they paired it with a center panel, and this became the T202. So again, the number goes down, but the years go up. If you fold them, you can then insert that in a pack of Hassan cigarettes, and that's the way these were issued. So they came out in the year of 1912, which, as I mentioned, just by coincidence, happened to be a magnificent year. This is the year when Smokey Joe Wood wins 34 games, Rube Marquard wins 19 in a row. This is the year that Fenway Park opens, Navin Field in Detroit opens, Redland Field, that later became Crosley Field in Cincinnati, opens. This is the year that Chief Wilson of the Pirates hits 36 triples, which is still the record for triples in a season. And this was the year when Ty Cobb famously vaulted into the stands at Hilltop Park in New York and beat a fan. And after that, the Tigers went on strike. So all these things are happening, culminating in a great World Series between the Red Sox and the Giants that goes 8 games and is won in the 10th inning of the 8th game. 8 games because the second game tied. So it's just a happy coincidence that the year when this wonderful card set came out, which I think is the most beautiful and also has the most detailed captions, it came out the same year of all these historic things. So I tried to bring them together and, as you say, use them also to say something about the society and the country in which this was all happening.
You know, I watch you demonstrate by folding the card, and I cringe a little bit, knowing how valuable these cards are. That you would be so cavalier as to show, which is a great demonstration of how they used to fit. I actually went. I found one online. It just, I was amazed at how small they are. Because I you know, a trifold, I expected something larger, but as you demonstrated, it has to fit into the package of cigarettes.
Well, and by the way, just in case you think I'm being very cavalier, I mean, this is a duplicate and it's one that already has a bit of a fold in it. So when I collected these over the years, if I had one that I thought needed to be upgraded, I would upgrade it. And so I've got a better one that's in an album. But funny thing happened, Ron. I began to collect these in the 70s when I was in high school. I pretty much completed the collection by the early 90s. And in the early 90s, when you would then get a card, they would come like this.
Right.
And that's the way it is today. And of course, that's what happens when you buy an expensive card. You want it to be protected and you want the rating to be clear. But I'm of the generation before that, and I have my cards in albums. I don't have all these plastic slabs. So it is true that now, if you wanted to collect these, you would probably get them this way. And there were a few I needed at the end. This is one where the only alternative was to buy it in a slab, but I have them from the previous time when you could actually hold them. And you had to do it carefully, but that's what we did.
This isn't the kind of card you would put in the spokes of your bicycle.
Probably not. No, sir.
How long did it, how did you go about collecting these? Because it's not like now you can go out and just buy a whole set in one shot. This, like you say, it took many years to do it. How did you find them? And what was it like getting the final card to complete the collection?
Well, I haven't quite completed it. There's, I think, 3 cards I don't have out of 132. I began to collect in high school. I probably bought about a dozen for a few dollars. That's what it cost in those days. And then I went off to college and didn't think much about it. My Fortunately, my mother never threw my cards out, so that was not the story of my life. And then, in the early 80s, when I was working and had a little more money, I would go to card shows and you'd pick up a few here and there. I moved to the East Coast in 1986, moved to Philadelphia. One of the first things I did is I went to the Willow Grove show. You may remember that. It was a big show. I went to one in Atlantic City, and here and there I would pick up a few more. And then I was working and I had a bit more money. There were some publications where you could see cards that were listed and you'd send off in the mail. The three that I don't have are some of the rarer ones. There's a variation. There was a third baseman named Art Devlin. He was a giant for a long time, and at the beginning of the 1912 season, his contract was sold to the Boston Rustlers, who later became the Boston Braves. Well, when they put the set together, they first show him as a giant, and there are some cards issued that show him as a giant, but they caught it in time, and then they made others where he's a rustler. Well, as you can imagine, some of those cards are fairly rare because there are not that many where he's a giant. And by the time I was completing the set, I thought, oh boy, I really don't want to pay that much. And I do have him as a rustler. So I do have in my collection every center panel, every end panel. I'm just missing a few of the variations. And it's probably also worth saying there are 76 different center panels. Many of them come with only one set of end panels, but about 25 come with multiple end panels, and the end panels sometimes appear on different center panels. Sounds complicated. It just means that it's an asymmetrical set. Now, what I did in my book, I wanted to make sure that every center panel is shown and every end panel is shown. But you don't need to have all 132 cards to do that. You need about 112 cards. And so those I show, and I did high resolution scans of all of those cards. And so and I present them in their actual size. So the book is a fair presentation of the entire set, every end panel, every center panel.
Do you have a favorite card, or is it like children, they're all your favorites and you couldn't possibly pick one favorite?
Well, I mean, who wouldn't like the ones that show Ty Cobb stealing third base, or for me to have Christy Mathewson paired with his catcher, Chief Myers? There's one I like a great deal called Jake Stahl guarding first. This is the player manager of the Red Sox on one side, center panel showing him guarding first base, and the other end panel has Eddie Seacott, who at that time was pitching for the Red Sox, and then he was traded to the White Sox, where he became infamous a number of years later. There's also some that have just wonderful images. You have players sliding into home plate and dust flying up, caught in mid-flight because the camera speed now is about 1/1000th of a second, or a pickoff throw at first base, the ball caught in midair. So there's some I like because of the end panels, there's some I like because what's depicted in the center. There's just so many that are wonderful.
The photography that you're talking about, the photographers in those days were actually on the field. They were on the first base side, third base side. That's kind of dangerous when you think about it.
Yes, I didn't see any reports of them being hit, but they could have been. I have seen photographs of the field where you would have one, maybe two photographers crouching right near first base and third base. One thing that's important to point out here, I mentioned these are the first examples of fast shutter speed photography, Graflex cameras that could freeze action at 1/1000th of a second, but they did not yet have telephoto lenses. So the photographers would be kneeling at first base or third. Occasionally, if a play was developing, they might run to home plate and catch a collision there. But there are no center panels that show a pitcher on the mound, or an outfielder going back to catch a ball, or a shortstop going deep in the hole. There are a few that are posed on sidelines, but mainly you've got photographs taken from first base, third base. Runners rounding third, sliding into third. There's one of Shoeless Joe Jackson. It's been identified as Joe Jackson sliding into third, although he's not named in the caption. It's understood as a card of Joe Jackson. So that's where the photographers were. Now, you mentioned they were on the field. Yes, they were on the field, but as of 1910, the National League forbade them from being on the field, which is why most of the action shots in the T202 set are of American League games. Most of them are either in Cleveland, League Park in Cleveland, where the photographer was Louis Van Oyen, or Hilltop Park in New York, where the photographer was Charles Conlin. There are some National League games, but they're all prior to 1910. So one of the things I did in putting this together, I wanted to find examples of the photographs on which the center panels were based. One of those center panels is very famous. It's the one of Ty Cobb stealing third base and knocking over Jimmy Austin. We all know that photograph. It's probably, I'd say, the most famous action photograph of the dead ball era. But I tried to find other photographs, and on many pages, you'll see the card, but then you'll see next to it the photograph on which the center panel was based. And oftentimes, you'll see that something was airbrushed out. The background might have been airbrushed out, or a player might have been airbrushed out to make the subjects that they wanted to portray a bit more prominent. So I tried to bring in as much as I could in this annotated presentation of the set about the photography, about the stadiums. I have a lot of postcards of stadiums, and then the captions on the back are annotated as well.
Talk about the annotations. What did you have to do to come up with those?
Well, I would read the captions and I would find either some point of fact about the player's career or some accomplishment, a day when this player, threw out six base runners or stole this many bases. And I would try to understand what was referred to there. And I would look at baseball reference, but I would look at articles from newspapers and I would give some background. But the other thing that I would see here, not just about players or events, there was a lot of terminology. There were phrases that I found interesting. Hal Chase, famous first baseman of the New York Yankees, at one point says he's quoted about playing first base. He was known as a great fielding first baseman, and because of his speed, he played off the base. He was left-handed, and he made the point that he believed that one day all first basemen would be left-handed. It would be as rare to find a right-handed first baseman as it is to find a left-handed second baseman, shortstop, third baseman. And he said one reason why is the sacrifice killing play is much easier for a left-hander. Well, I'd never heard of that. What is a sacrifice killing play? I know what a sacrifice is, but this was something that you saw in the dead ball era, where baseball, the balls weren't hit as far. There was a lot more station to station, a lot more bunting, a lot more infield play. And imagine you've got a runner at second base. Now, today we might say, well, you don't want to bump the runner to third. He's already in scoring position, swing away. But sometimes you do try to bunt them over. Well, in those days, you often tried to bunt them over. And if the bunt is going towards the first baseman, what he tries to do is run in and in one motion throw to third to catch the runner going from second to third, thereby killing the sacrifice. So that was called the sacrifice killing play. There were a number of other terms. There were they didn't call switch hitters in those days. They would say something like he can hit from either side according to his fancy. Well, that's interesting. Today we just say the person's a switch hitter. So the things I found that were worth commenting on were either about the players or about events or oftentimes about the way the game was played. And the way the game was played was different in the dead ball era. And the way photography was representing the game was also somewhat different. And so the captions sometimes spoke to the photograph on the center panel and made interesting observations that I think captured the early nature of sports photography.
Well, one of the things that I notice in reading books from that era, like you say, the language is much different. It's much more evocative. Nowadays, it's you don't find that kind of writing anymore because there are other ways to take in the game.
There's something else I'll add to that. The way that player performance was described. Now, in those days, everybody knew what a batting average was, and everybody talked about home runs. But for pitchers, they talked about your percentage. Well, that was your win-loss percentage. They did not yet have earned run average. That only began the year later. And so there was some kind of description of, well, this pitcher doesn't let too many of the opponents score, but there was not yet a metric for earned run average. There was talk about he brings in his teammates, but there was not yet, until I think 1920, a statistic called runs batted in. They talk about the number of bases, by which they mean total bases, but there was not yet something called slugging percentage. So it's quite interesting here on the back, the way you see performance being understood in those days.
Yeah, I wonder if there was much outrage in those days when they would come up with a statistic like RBI or ERA, as they do now when they talk about war, and some people are saying, oh my God, you know, too much, too much, too much.
Oh, I don't know what the reception was. You have a hunch here that there was a desire for a way to capture something that was understood to be important. But now, yeah, I think it's the other way around. Now there's just this incredible proliferation of statistics, and I find it difficult sometimes when I see the way sports writers talk about player performance, and it's like, what's that again? Come again?
Now, this book is self-published. It's one of the best examples of self-publishing I've come across. It is, and as most, I would imagine, most self-published authors, it's a labor of love.
Yes, very, very much so. I'd wanted to do this for a while. I waited until I had the right designer because I could have designed it myself. It wouldn't have looked good. But there was a book that came out a few years ago called Game Faces, and this was based on an exhibit at the Smithsonian. And when I read through this, I thought, ah, whoever designed this really has a great eye. So I contacted them. I contacted the Smithsonian. I said, who did the design? They put me in touch with Studio A in Alexandria, Virginia. And they are really responsible for the look. I mean, I knew what I wanted to do, and all the words are mine, and the choice of images is mine. But everything about colors and spacing and fonts is their eye. And so yes, it's an expensive proposition because the design, the publishing, the printing, the shipping, the website. So it's not something you're going to make money on, but in order to do it at a commercial quantity, you have to, I wanted it hardback, and I wanted it to have the right kind of binding. So I decided, I'm at a time in my life, I thought, well, why not do it, and then we'll just try to sell as many as we can, and hope that we won't finish in the red and the black. We'll finish somewhere in the red, but maybe not too bad.
Well, as I said, this is the perfect time of year for this to come out. It's One Splendid Season, Baseball in America, 1912. We've been talking with the author, Phil Rosenzweig. And before we let you go, you mentioned a website. What's the website?
So the website is where I have my book, this book and others. It's pmrbooks.com, PMRbooks, all there's no underscore or space. Or you can go to Amazon. And if Amazon's the best way to get a copy, if you just go to Amazon, put One Splendid Season, it'll come up. Either way, PMR Books or Amazon, and it's fulfilled from a fulfillment center in Michigan. Doesn't matter which way you order, you'll get it just as fast. So I hope it'll be enjoyed by many people. It's been reviewed a few times, and I've been really tickled to see that a lot of the orders have come from women. Now, maybe there's a lot of women baseball fans and baseball card collectors, but I think a lot of them are seeing this possibly as a gift, and that's great. Doesn't matter to me. I just think it's a fun thing to share, and I hope people enjoy it.
Well, it certainly was fun for me to read, and I really appreciate it. Phil, thank you very much for talking with us today, and best of luck in the future.
Thank you, Ron.